she shrugged, spreading her hands in a gesture of helpless sadness because they both knew the answer. She asked, "He did mean a great deal to you, didn't he?"
"He does."
The two dots of fire at the tips of their cigarettes had moved slowly to the tips of their fingers, with the small glow of an occasional flare and the soft crumbling of ashes as sole movement in the silence, when the doorbell rang. They knew that it was not the man they wished, but could not hope to see, return, and she frowned with sudden anger as she went to open the door. It took her a moment to remember that the innocuously courteous figure she saw bowing to her with a standard smile of welcome was the assistant manager of the apartment house.
"Good evening, Miss Taggart. We're so glad to see you back. I just came on duty and heard that you had returned, and wanted to greet you in person."
"Thank you." She stood at the door, not moving to admit him.
"I have a letter that came for you about a week ago, Miss Taggart," he said, reaching into his pocket. "It looked as if it might be important, but being marked personal, it was obviously not intended to be sent to your office, and besides, they did not know your address either. So, not knowing where to forward it, I kept it in our safe, and I thought I'd deliver it to you in person."
The envelope he handed to her was marked, "Registered, Airmail, Special Delivery, Personal." The return address said, "Quentin Daniels, Utah Institute of Technology, Afton, Utah."
"Oh, thank you."
The assistant manager noted that her voice went dropping toward a whisper, the polite disguise for a gasp. He noted that she stood looking down at the sender's name much longer than was necessary. So he repeated his good wishes and departed. She was tearing the envelope open as she walked toward Reardon, and she stopped in the middle of the room to read the letter. It was typewritten on thin paper. He could see the black rectangles of the paragraphs through the transparent sheets, and he could see her face as she read them. He expected it by the time he saw her come to the end. She leaped to the telephone. He heard the violent whirl of the dial and her voice saying with trembling urgency,
"Long distance, please. Operator, get me the Utah Institute of Technology at Afton, Utah."
He asked, approaching, "What is it?" She extended the letter, not looking at him, her eyes fixed on the telephone as if she could force it to answer. The letter said,
"Dear Miss Taggart, I fought it out for 3 weeks. I did not want to do it. I know how this will hit you, and I know every argument you could offer me, because I've used them all against myself. But this is to tell you that I'm quitting. I cannot work under the terms of Directive 10-289, though not for the reasons its perpetrators intended. I know that their abolition of all scientific research does not mean a damn to you or me, and that you would want me to continue. But I have to quit, because I do not wish to succeed any longer. I do not wish to work in a world that regards me as a slave. I do not wish to be of any value to people. If I succeeded in rebuilding the motor, I would not let you place it in their service. I would not take it upon my conscience that anything produced by my mind should be used to bring them comfort. I know that if we succeed, they will be only too eager to expropriate the motor, and for the sake of that prospect, we have to accept the position of criminals, you and I, and live under the threat of being arrested at any moment at their whim. And this is the thing that I cannot take, even were I able to take all the rest, that in order to give them an inestimable benefit, we should be made martyrs to the men who but for us could not have conceived of it. I might have forgiven the rest, but when I think of this, I say, may they be damned. I will see them all die of starvation, myself included, rather than forgive them for this or permit it. To tell you the full truth, I want to succeed, to solve the secret of the motor as much as ever. So I shall continue to work on it for my own sole pleasure and for as long as I last. But if I solve it, it will remain my private secret. I will not release it for any commercial use. Therefore, I cannot take your money any longer. Commercialism is supposed to be despicable, so all those people should truly approve of my decision, and I'm tired of helping those who despise me. I don't know how long I will last or what I will do in the future. For the moment, I intend to remain in my job at this institute. But if any of its trustees or receivers should remind me that I'm now legally forbidden to cease being a janitor, I will quit. You had given me my greatest chance, and if I'm now giving you a painful blow, perhaps I should ask you to forgive me. I think that you love your work as much as I loved mine. So you will know that my decision was not easy to make, but that I had to make it. It is a strange feeling, writing this letter. I do not intend to die, but I'm giving up the world. And this feels like the letter of a suicide. So I want to say that of all the people I've known, you are the only person I regret leaving behind. Sincerely yours, Quentin Daniels. When he looked up from the letter, he heard her saying, as he had heard her through the words of the typewritten lines, her voice rising closer to despair each time, "Keep ringing, operator. Please, keep ringing."
"What can you tell him?" he asked.
"There are no arguments to offer." "I won't have a chance to tell him. He's gone by now. It was a week ago. I'm sure he's gone." "They've got him."
"Who got him?"
"Yes, operator, I'll hold the line. Keep trying."
"What would you tell him if he answered?"
"I'd beg him to go on taking my money with no strings attached, no conditions, just so he'll have the means to continue. I'll promise him that if we're still in a looter's world, when and if he succeeds, I won't ask him to give me the motor or even to tell me its secret. But if by that time we're free..."
She stopped. "If we're free..."
"All I want from him now is that he doesn't give up and vanish like all those others. I don't want to let them get him. If it's not too late..." "Oh, God, I don't want them to get him." "Yes, operator, keep ringing."
"What good will it do us, even if he continues to work?"
"That's all I'll beg him to do, just to continue. Maybe we'll never get a chance to use the motor in the future, but I want to know that somewhere in the world there's still a great brain at work on a great attempt, and that we still have a chance at a future. If that motor is abandoned again, then there's nothing but Starnesville ahead of us."
"Yes, I know."
She held the receiver pressed to her ear, her arms stiff with the effort not to tremble. She waited, and he heard in the silence the futile clicking of the unanswered call.
"He's gone," she said. "They got him.
A week is much longer than they need.
I don't know how they learn when the time is right, but this..."
She pointed at the letter.
"This was their time, and they wouldn't have missed it."
"Who?"
"The destroyer's agents."
"Are you beginning to think that they really exist?"
"Yes."
"Are you serious?"
"I am.
I've met one of them."
"Who?" "I'll tell you later. I don't know who their leader is, but I'm going to find out one of these days. I'm going to find out. I'll be damned if I let them..."
She broke off on a gasp. He saw the change in her face the moment before he heard the click of a distant receiver being lifted, and the sound of a man's voice saying across the wire,
"Hello? Daniels, is that you? You're alive? You're still there?"
"Why, yes. Is this you, Miss Taggart? What's the matter?"
I thought you were gone."
"Oh, I'm sorry. I just heard the phone ringing. I was out in the back lot gathering carrots."
"Carrots?"
She was laughing with hysterical relief. "I have my own vegetable patch out there. Used to be the Institute's parking lot."
"Are you calling from New York, Miss Taggart?"
"Yes, I just received your letter just now. I had been away."
"Oh." There was a pause.
Then he said quietly,
"There's really nothing more to be said about it, Miss Taggart."
"Tell me, are you going away?"
"No."
"You're not planning to go?"
"No." "Where?"
"Do you intend to remain at the Institute?"
"Yes."
"For how long? Indefinitely?"
"Yes, as far as I know."
"Has anyone approached you?"
"About what?"
"About leaving."
"No."
"Who?"
"Listen, Daniels, I won't try to discuss your letter over the phone, but I must speak to you. I'm coming to see you. I'll get there as fast as I can."
"I don't want you to do that, Miss Taggart. I don't want you to go to such an effort when it's useless."
"Give me a chance, won't you? You don't have to promise to change your mind. You don't have to commit yourself to anything, only to give me a hearing. If I want to come, it's my risk. I'm taking it. There are things I want to say to you. I'm asking you only for the chance to say them."
"You know that I will always give you that chance, Miss Taggart."
"I'm leaving for Utah at once, tonight. But there's one thing I want you to promise me. Will you promise to wait for me? Will you promise to be there when I arrive?"
"Why?"
"Of course, Miss Taggart, unless I die or something happens outside my power. But I don't expect it to happen."
"Unless you die, you will wait for me no matter what happens?"
"Of course."
"Do you give me your word that you'll wait?"
"Yes, Miss Taggart."
"Thank you. Good night."
"Good night, Miss Taggart."
She pressed the receiver down and picked it up again in the same sweep of her hand and rapidly dialed a number. "Eddie, have them hold the Comet for me. Yes, tonight's Comet. Give orders to have my car attached, then come here to my place at once."
She glanced at her watch.
"It's 8:12. I have an hour to make it. I don't think I'll hold them up too long. I'll talk to you while I pack.
She hung up and turned to Reardon. Tonight, he said, I have to.
I guess so. Don't you have to go to Colorado anyway?
Yes, I intended to leave tomorrow night, but I think Eddie can manage to take care of my office, and I'd better start now. It takes 3 days, she remembered. It will now take 5 days to reach Utah. I have to go by train. There are people I have to see on the line. This can't be delayed either.
How long will you stay in Colorado?
Hard to tell.
Wire me when you get there, will you? If it looks as if it's going to be long, I'll join you there.
This was the only expression he could give to the words he had desperately wished to say to her, had waited for, had come here to say, and now wished to pronounce more than ever, but knew that it must not be said tonight. She knew, by a faint, solemn stress in the tone of his voice, that this was his acceptance of her confession, his surrender, his forgiveness. She asked, "Can you leave the mills?"
"It will take me a few days to arrange, but I can."
He knew what her words were admitting, acknowledging, and forgiving him, when she said, "Hank, why don't you meet me in Colorado in a week? If you fly your plane, we'll both get there at the same time, and then we'll come back together."
"All right, dearest."
She dictated a list of instructions while pacing her bedroom, gathering her clothes, hastily packing a suitcase. Reardon had left. Eddie Willer sat at a dressing table making notes. He seemed to work in his usual manner of unquestioning efficiency, as if he were not aware of the perfume bottles and powder boxes, as if the dressing table were a desk and the room were only an office. "I'll phone you from Chicago, Omaha, Flagstaff, and Afton," she said, tossing underwear into the suitcase. "If you need me in between, call any operator along the line with orders to flag the train."
"The Comet?" he asked mildly.
"Hell yes, the Comet."
"Okay.
Don't hesitate to call if you have to."
"Okay. But I don't think I'll have to."
"We'll manage. We'll work by long-distance phone, just as we did when we..." She stopped.
"When we were building the John Galt line?" he asked quietly.
They glanced at each other, but said nothing else. "What's the latest report on the construction crews?" she asked.
"Everything's underway. I got word just after you left the office that the grading gangs have started, out of Laurel, Kansas, and out of Jasper, Oklahoma. The rail is on its way to them from Silver Springs. It will be all right. The hardest thing to find was..."
"The men?"
"Yes, the men to put in charge. We had trouble out west over the Elgin to Midland stretch. All the men we were counting on are gone. I couldn't find anyone able to assume responsibility, neither on our line nor elsewhere. I even tried to get Dan Conway, but..."
"Dan Conway?" she asked, stopping.
"Yes, I did. I tried. Do you remember how he used to have rail laid at the rate of 5 miles a day right in that part of the country? Oh, I know he'd have reason to hate our guts, but what does it matter now? I found him. He's living on a ranch out in Arizona. I phoned him myself and I begged him to save us, just to take charge for one night of building 5.5 miles of track. 5.5 miles, Dagny, that we're stuck with, and he's the greatest railroad builder living. I told him that I was asking him to do it as a gesture of charity to us, if he would. You know, I think he understood me. He wasn't angry. He sounded sad. But he wouldn't do it. He said one must not try to bring people back out of the grave. He wished me luck. I think he meant it. You know, I don't think he's one of those that the destroyer knocked out. I think he just broke by himself."
"Yes, I know he did."
Eddie saw the expression on her face and pulled himself up hastily. "Oh, we finally found a man to put in charge at Elgin," he said, forcing his voice to sound confident. "Don't worry. The track will be built long before you get there."
She glanced at him with the faint suggestion of a smile, thinking of how often she had said these words to him, and of the desperate bravery with which he was now trying to tell her, "Don't worry." He caught her glance, he understood, and the answering hint of his smile had a touch of embarrassed apology. He turned back to his notepad, feeling anger at himself, sensing that he had broken his own unstated commandment, "Don't make it harder for her." He should not have told her about Dan Conway, he thought. He should not have said anything to remind them both of the despair they would feel, if they felt. He wondered what was the matter with him. He thought it inexcusable that he should find his discipline slipping just because this was a room, not an office. she went on speaking, and he listened, looking down at his pad, making a brief notation once in a while. He did not permit himself to look at her again. She threw the door of her closet open, jerked a suit off a hanger, and folded it rapidly, while her voice went on with unhurried precision. He did not look up. He was aware of her only by means of sound, the sound of the swift movements and of the measured voice. He knew what was wrong with him, he thought. He did not want her to leave. He did not want to lose her again after so brief a moment of reunion. But to indulge any personal loneliness at a time when he knew how desperately the railroad needed her in Colorado was an act of disloyalty he had never committed before, and he felt a vague, desolate sense of guilt. "Send out orders that the Comet is to stop at every division point," she said, "and that all division superintendents are to prepare for me a report on—" He glanced up. Then his glance stopped, and he did not hear the rest of the words. He saw a man's dressing gown hanging on the back of the open closet door, a dark blue gown with the white initials H.R. on its breast pocket. He remembered where he had seen that gown before. He remembered the man facing him across a breakfast table in the Wayne Falkland Hotel. He remembered that man coming unannounced to her office late on a Thanksgiving night. And the realization that he should have known it came to him as two subterranean jolts of a single earthquake. It came with the feeling that screamed, "No," so savagely, that the scream, not the sight, brought down every girder within him. It was not the shock of the discovery, but the more terrible shock of what it made him discover about himself. He hung on to a single thought, that he must not let her see what he had noticed or what it had done to him. He felt a sensation of embarrassment, magnified to the point of physical torture. It was the dread of violating her privacy twice, by learning her secret and by revealing his own. He bent lower over the notepad and concentrated on an immediate purpose: to stop his pencil from shaking. 50 miles of mountain trackage to build, and we can count on nothing but whatever material we own. "I beg your pardon," he said, his voice barely audible. "I didn't hear what you said." "I said I want a report from all superintendents on every foot of rail and every piece of equipment available on their divisions." "Okay. I will confer with each of them in turn. Have them meet me in my car aboard the Comet." "Okay. Send word out unofficially that the engineers are to make up time for the stops by going 70, 80, 100 miles an hour, anything they wish, as and when they need to, and that I will—"
"Eddie?"
"Yes, okay."
"Eddie, what's the matter?"
He had to look up, to face her, and desperately to lie for the first time in his life. I'm afraid of the trouble we'll get into with the law," he said.
"Forget it. Don't you see that there isn't any law left? Anything goes now for whoever can get away with it, and for the moment it's we who're setting the terms."
When she was ready, he carried her suitcase to a taxicab, then down the platform of the Taggart terminal to her office car, the last at the end of the Comet. He stood on the platform, saw the train jerk forward, and watched the red markers on the back of her car slipping slowly away from him into the long darkness of the exit tunnel. When they were gone, he felt what one feels at the loss of a dream one had not known till after it was lost. There were few people on the platform around him, and they seemed to move with self-conscious strain, as if a sense of disaster clung to the rails and to the girders above their heads. He thought indifferently that after a century of safety, men were once more regarding the departure of a train as an event involving a gamble with death. He remembered that he had had no dinner, and he felt no desire to eat. But the underground cafeteria of the Taggart terminal was more truly his home than the empty cube of space he now thought of as his apartment. So he walked to the cafeteria, because he had no other place to go. The cafeteria was almost deserted, but the first thing he saw as he entered was a thin column of smoke rising from the cigarette of the worker, who sat alone at a table in a dark corner. Not noticing what he put on his tray, Eddie carried it to the worker's table, said hello, sat down, and said nothing else. He looked at the silverware spread before him, wondered about its purpose, remembered the use of a fork, and attempted to perform the motions of eating, but found that it was beyond his power. After a while he looked up and saw that the worker's eyes were studying him attentively. "No," said Eddie.
No, there's nothing the matter with me. Oh, yes, a lot has happened, but what difference does it make now? Yes, she's back. What else do you want me to say about it? How did you know she's back? Oh, well, I suppose the whole company knew it within the first 10 minutes. No, I don't know whether I'm glad that she's back. Sure, she'll save the railroad for another year or month. What do you want me to say? No, she didn't. She didn't tell me what she's counting on. She didn't tell me what she thought or felt. Well, how do you suppose she'd feel? It's hell for her. All right, for me too, only my kind of hell is my own fault. No, nothing. I can't talk about it. Talk? I mustn't even think about it. I've got to stop it. Stop thinking of her and... of her, I mean. He remained silent, and he wondered why the worker's eyes, the eyes that always seemed to see everything within him, made him feel uneasy tonight. He glanced down at the table, and he noticed the butts of many cigarettes among the remnants of food on the worker's plate. "Are you in trouble, too?" asked Eddie. "Oh, just that you've sat here for a long time tonight, haven't you?" "For me? Why should you have wanted to wait for me?" "You know, I never thought you cared whether you saw me or not, me or anybody. You seemed so complete in yourself, and that's why I liked to talk to you, because I felt that you always understood, but nothing could hurt you. You looked as if nothing had ever hurt you, and it made me feel free, as if there were no pain in the world. Do you know what's strange about your face? You look as if you've never known pain, or fear, or guilt. I'm sorry I'm so late tonight. I had to see her off. She has just left on the Comet." "Yes, tonight, just now." "Yes, she's gone." "Yes, it was a sudden decision within the past hour. She intended to leave tomorrow night, but something unexpected happened, and she had to go at once." "Yes, she's going to Colorado afterwards, to Utah first. Because she got a letter from Quentin Daniels that he's quitting, and the one thing she won't give up, couldn't stand to give up, is the motor. You remember the motor I told you about, the remnant that she found?" "Daniels. He's a physicist who's been working for the past year at the Utah Institute of Technology, trying to solve the secret of the motor and to rebuild it." "Why do you look at me like that?" "No, I haven't told you about him before because it was a secret. It was a private secret project of her own. And of what interest would it have been to you anyway?" "I guess I can talk about it now because he's quit." "Yes, he told her his reasons. He said that he won't give anything produced by his mind to a world that regards him as a slave. He said that he won't be made a martyr to people in exchange for giving them an inestimable benefit." "What? What are you laughing at?" "Stop it, will you? Why do you laugh like that?" "The whole secret? What do you mean, the whole secret? He hasn't found the whole secret of the motor, if that's what you meant. But he seemed to be doing well. He had a good chance. Now it's lost. She's rushing to him. She wants to plead, to hold him, to make him go on. But I think it's useless. Once they stop, they don't come back again. Not one of them has." "No, I don't care. Not anymore. We've taken so many losses that I'm getting used to it." "Oh, no. It's not Daniels that I can't take. It's..." "No, drop it. Don't question me about it. The whole world is going to pieces. She's still fighting to save it, and I sit here damning her for something I had no right to know." "No, she's done nothing to be damned. Nothing. And besides, it doesn't concern the railroad." "Don't pay any attention to me. It's not true. It's not her that I'm damning. It's myself. Listen, I've always known that you loved Taggart Transcontinental as I loved it, that it meant something special to you, something personal, and that was why you liked to hear me talk about it. But this, the thing I learned today, this has nothing to do with the railroad. It would be of no importance to you. Forget it. It's something that I didn't know about her, that's all. I grew up with her. I thought I knew her. I didn't. I don't know what it was that I expected. I suppose I just thought that she had no private life of any kind. To me, she was not a person and not a woman. She was the railroad. And I didn't think that anyone would ever have the audacity to look at her in any other way. Well, it serves me right. Forget it." "Forget it," I said. "Why do you question me like this? It's only her private life. What can it matter to you?" "Drop it, for God's sake. Don't you see that I can't talk about it?" "Nothing happened. Nothing's wrong with me. I just..." "Oh, why am I lying? I can't lie to you. You always seem to see everything. It's worse than trying to lie to myself. I have lied to myself. I didn't know what I felt for her. The railroad? I'm a rotten hypocrite. If the railroad was all she meant to me, it wouldn't have hit me like this. I wouldn't have felt that I wanted to kill him. What's the matter with you tonight? Why do you look at me like that? Oh, what's the matter with all of us? Why is there nothing but misery left for anyone? Why do we suffer so much? We weren't meant to. I always thought that we were to be happy, all of us, as our natural fate. What are we doing? What have we lost? A year ago, I wouldn't have damned her for finding something she wanted. But I know that they're doomed, both of them, and so am I, and so is everybody, and she was all I had left. It was so great to be alive. It was such a wonderful chance. I didn't know that I loved it, and that that was our love, hers and mine, and yours. But the world is perishing, and we cannot stop it. Why are we destroying ourselves? Who will tell us the truth? Who will save us? Oh, who is John Galt? No, it's no use. It doesn't matter now. Why should I feel anything? We won't last much longer. Why should I care what she does? Why should I care that she's sleeping with Hank Reardon? Oh, God, what's the matter with you? Don't go. Where are you going?
This book is continued on Disc 3.
Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, Part 2 continued.
Disc 3.
Chapter 10. The Sign of the Dollar. She sat at the window of the train, her head thrown back, not moving, wishing she would never have to move again. The telegraph poles went racing past the window, but the train seemed lost in a void, between a brown stretch of prairie and a solid spread of rusty graying clouds. The twilight was draining the sky without the wound of a sunset. It looked more like the fading of an anemic body in the process of exhausting its last drops of blood and light. The train was going west, as if it too were pulled to follow the sinking rays and quietly to vanish from the earth. She sat still, feeling no desire to resist it. She wished she would not hear the sound of the wheels. They knocked in an even rhythm, every fourth knock accented, and it seemed to her that through the rapid running clatter of some futile stampede to escape, the beat of the accented knocks was like the steps of an enemy moving toward some inexorable purpose. She had never experienced it before, this sense of apprehension at the sight of a prairie, this feeling that the rail was only a fragile thread stretched across an enormous emptiness, like a worn nerve, ready to break. She had never expected that she, who had felt as if she were the motive power aboard a train, would now sit wishing like a child or a savage that this train would move, that it would not stop, that it would get her there on time, wishing it. Not like an act of will, but like a plea to a dark unknown. She thought of what a difference 1 month had made. She had seen it in the faces of the men at the stations, the track workers, the switchmen, the yardmen, who had always greeted her anywhere along the line, their cheerful grins boasting that they knew who she was, had now looked at her stonily, turning away, their faces wary and closed. She had wanted to cry to them an apology, "It's not I who've done it to you." Then had remembered that she had accepted it, and that they now had the right to hate her, that she was both a slave and a driver of slaves, and so was every human being in the country, and hatred was the only thing that men could now feel for one another. She had found reassurance for 2 days in the sight of the cities moving past her window, the factories, the bridges, the electric signs, the billboards pressing down upon the roofs of homes, the crowded, grimy, active, living conflux of the industrial East. But the cities had been left behind. The train was now diving into the prairies of Nebraska, the rattle of its couplers sounding as if it were shivering with cold. She saw lonely shapes that had been farmhouses and the vacant stretches that had been fields. But the great burst of energy in the East, generations ago, had splattered bright trickles to run through the emptiness. Some were gone, but some still lived. She was startled when the lights of a small town swept across her car, and vanishing, left it darker than it had been before. She would not move to turn on the light. She sat still, watching the rare towns. Whenever an electric beam went flashing briefly at her face, it was like a moment's greeting.